and welcome to the TNW podcast, the show in which we discuss the latest developments in the European technology ecosystem and feature occasional interviews with some of the most interesting people in the industry. My name is Andriy Rigler. I am the head of media at TNW.
I'm Ioana Likerdopoulou, reporter at TNW.
It is too bad that today Linnea was not able to join us. She's a bit sick at home without a voice. So Linnea, if you're listening to this, we really, really hope that you're feeling better now and we miss you dearly.
We really do.
Ioana, how are you doing in the meantime?
I'm really good. I'm really happy that I'm here today, even though that means Linnea is sick. And I'm very interested in how your trip was.
Right. Yeah. I spent most of the last week in Riga at the Tech Chill conference, which is really nice. It's a really small conference. I just realized the other day that it's exactly the size that TNW conference was 12 years ago when I attended it. So it's about 2,500 people. And it's a really interesting size. It feels like sometimes it feels like, you know, half of the people at least attending the conference. So for me, it's just always good to catch up with people I know from the Baltic ecosystem in particular,
yeah,
and see what's going on. I brought back some great interviews, one of which we will be running later today. So you should definitely listen to that one.
Well, that's amazing. Great to hear.
Now, in addition to that, we are going to discuss today the potentially good news about ASML's future in the Netherlands, the latest developments at Stability AI, carbon capture solutions, and much more. And as I said, you will hear an interview. It is with Sebastian Aristotelis, whose title is co-founder and lead architect at Saga Space Architects, which is a Danish company that, indeed, wants to build human habitats to use on other planets.
I can't wait for that.
But before we get to that, let's talk about our own stories. So what is the story that you, Ioana, covered that you would like to highlight today?
So what you said before about potentially big news and great news for ASML and the Dutch tech industry is true. Last week, we talked about the Dutch government's efforts to keep machine giant ASML in the country. This week, it looks like things are actually going to work out,
Okay. Or
most probably are going to work out. Just as a quick background for those unfamiliar with the crown jewel of the Netherlands ecosystem, ASML is a world-leading manufacturer of chip-making machines. It's also the world's sole supplier of EUV, which stands for Extreme Ultraviolet Lithography Machines, which are essential to producing the most advanced computer chips, the one used by NVIDIA, for example, and Intel. This makes ASML the most viable tech company in Europe and naturally in the Netherlands, where it employs about 20,000 people. Back to the story. On Monday, ASML signed a letter of intent with the city council of Eindhoven to explore a potential expansion in the Brainport region, a major tech and innovation hub in the country.
Yeah, I've heard of Brainport before. I think we should do a feature about it because, yeah, I think they house a lot of interesting companies. Actually.
Yeah, I think so too. It's a pretty cool area to be as well, and it's great that you have these type of clusters in a country, mm-hmm, instead of. Yeah.
Yeah. So, what's it gonna mean in practice? What kind of deal is it?
Well, the potential deal shows that the government's efforts have managed, or are at least managing, to alleviate ASML's fears over the lack of talent and the overall business climate in the Netherlands. There were some rumors that it was considering relocating. Mm-hmm. The end results of the government's efforts was Operation Beethoven, a 2.5 billion initiative launched last month to improve infrastructure, technical education, housing, and talent attraction, with a special focus on the Eindhoven region. And obviously, all of the above are crucial aspects for accommodating ASML's expansion.
Yeah, I think ASML really highlighted the need for attracting talent.
Yes.
And this is why they were hinting at a possibility of going somewhere else and expanding in France, just in order to make sure that they have enough talent flowing into the company to keep the business going.
Exactly. And I think the past year, talent attraction is a huge and major challenge for everyone. So
why was the news potentially good and not just good?
Because the deal isn't set in stone yet. The final decision and the further discussions are going to take place during summer, so in July and June. And then we will actually know whether ASML will move forwards and further expand in Eindhoven, which would also mean an extra 20,000 people in its workforce based in the Netherlands.
Right. I think it's also worth mentioning that this entire negotiation between ASML and the Dutch government is going on while we don't really have a proper government in this country. So the current government that's doing the negotiations is the so-called caretaker government. So basically the former government that is outgoing, and everything will change when we have a coalition that the chosen party leaders have been trying to make for already like 3 months at least, I think.
I think at least, exactly.
So it's really interesting also how that will play into this negotiations, and whether the new people coming in charge of the relevant ministries and relevant regulatory bodies, how they would think about the needs of ASML and whether they would want to be as receptive to them as the previous outgoing government.
Yeah, precisely. I think it's going to be an ongoing process for now, but the importance of the company staying in the Netherlands is still quite big. So.
Yeah, exactly. So let's move on to the next story, and that's a story that we did not cover, but that was covered elsewhere, and I wanted to highlight this one just for the sake of consistency, if nothing else, because I wanted to talk about stability AI. Once again, there is news, and once again, the news is largely not great for the company. So let's see. Last week, Wednesday, Stability announced that it had laid off more than 20 people, and that is about 10% of its global workforce. The news comes a few weeks after Stability's then CEO Imad Mostak departed the company, and a few months after the company also lost several senior researchers, including some of the people who were behind the initial first version of the stable diffusion model that the company relies upon in its work. So the newly appointed co-CEOs of Stability AI, now the company has two, and their names are Shanshan Wong and Christian Laforte, they sent a memo to the company employees about the latest round of redundancies. So here's a brief quote from that, and the quote begins, "These decisions have not been taken lightly, and they are intended to right-size parts of the business and focus our operations, which is critical to setting us on a more sustainable path," the quote ends.
Okay, yes, that sounds like largely bad news. Are there any good news?
Yes, there is actually good news. Well, positive news, let's put it this way, because in the meantime, Stability AI also released the API of its latest text-to-image model family, which is Stable Diffusion 3 and Stable Diffusion 3 Turbo. The model itself was announced first, I think, in February this year, and it is already available to a very limited number of people through an early preview. They also say that Stable Diffusion 3 outperforms other text-to-image models available on the market, such as Midjourney and DALL-E and so on. So it's a great thing, I think, that Stability is still able to keep shipping new products amidst the turmoil. But I have to say that I'm really wondering whether this kind of restructuring can indeed set the company on the right track. But in all honesty, I still think that this story may very well end up in an acquisition deal with one of the major tech players. So we're going to keep an eye on the developments here, but if you've got any comments, any insights, please do ping us on podcast@thenextweb.com. We're always, always very happy to hear from you. Now, moving on to the next segment, which is This Week We Learned. Ioana, today is your time to shine. What have you learned this week?
What I've learned isn't really shiny, to be honest. It's more alarming and gloomy, I would say, because it's about the latest report from the EU's Copernicus Climate Monitoring Service and the World Meteorological Organization. The findings are very worrying, to say the least.
Well, I wouldn't expect anything else from these particular bodies, but what did they see this time?
So let's start with the biggest learning. Europe is the fastest warming continent across the globe. and temperatures are rising at around twice the global average rate. So this is...
that does not sound great, especially living in the Netherlands with all the water around.
No. And last year showed some terrible signs as well. So our continent endured a record number of extreme heat stress in 2023. This means more or less that the feeling of the temperature is above 40 degrees. And also the death rate from hot weather has risen by about 30% in the past 20 years.
Okay, this is not great at all.
It's not. I hope there is hope, and the hope is that we can still take some steps to prevent the worst case scenario. Technology can obviously help on that. For example, I read about one interesting carbon capture solution. It's called biomass burial, which simply means burying dead trees underground so they don't release carbon dioxide in the atmosphere after the end of their life.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
So this is your learning. You can bury trees underground,
yes,
and this way you would capture carbon dioxide.
Exactly.
Wow, that's quite amazing. I've never heard of that. I'm gonna read it up after we finish recording. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Ioana. Let's move to today's interview. As I said at the beginning, this is one with Sebastian Aristoteles, who is the co-founder and lead architect at Saga Space Architects. I first met Sebastian last year, actually, at another conference called Tech Barbecue in Copenhagen. And since then, I really wanted to record a proper podcast interview with him. And last week, we met again in Riga at Tech Chill, and we sat down to discuss the company, the products, the vision. And also, Sebastian shared some of his stories and learnings of spending 100 days in one of Saga's habitats, which was placed 1,000 kilometers above the Arctic Circle in Greenland. So I promise this one is definitely worth a listen, and here it comes. So, Sebastian, thank you so much for taking the time, and welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So can we talk about yourself? So before you founded Saga Space Architects, what did you do? Did you have anything to do with what you're doing right now?
I founded Saga Space Architects when I was quite young. It's almost six years ago. So I was 23, 24 at the time. I was a student right before. So we started it kind of at the end of our last semester after we won a large competition. And that was at an architecture school.
All right. So it was architecture school. So your co-founders were also architects.
One co-founder as an architect, another co-founder as a programmer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
great. So what was your vision for the company when you started it?
It's kind of funny because our vision was quite naive and ambitious at the same time. And we are actually fulfilling that vision every year. Mm-hmm. And it almost, the plan that we made 5 years ago, year by year, it's happening. There's luck involved, but I'm still surprised that the naive idea of making space architecture and habitats for extreme environments in the Arctic and all of that, it's actually working out. We are 15, 16 people now, and mm-hmm. this is our bread and butter, right?
Right. So what's the current vision? What's the reason for the company to exist?
There's two visions, right? Mm-hmm. And for the last 50 years, humans have survived in space, in outer space, since the Apollo program. And we are pretty good at surviving in space now. Mm-hmm. In the last recent years, the industry is slowly shifting towards thriving in space. Mm. And that's kind of where we come in. So we want more civilian astronauts in space, and they cannot live in a laboratory. They cannot live in a technical machine that keeps you alive. Mm-hmm. They need a stimulating, healthy home. And that's kind of, that's what we are very good at. The other thing that we do is we want to change the way we build mm-hmm. on Earth, not just in space, but on Earth, using technology. So the building industry is very slow at adapting. I think if you look at agricultural industry in the last 50 years, it's increased 16 times in productivity. And the building industry is the same, right? A construction worker 60 years, 70 years ago can make the same in 1 hour as they can today. That's kind of the only industry that's falling behind. So I think with the 3D printing and with new sustainable manufacturing techniques and materials, I think we can do some very interesting architecture.
Right. But is so? But is the end game still to build something to be used in space or on other planets?
Absolutely. So just like you call SpaceX when you need to send something in orbit or mm-hmm. soon when you need to send something to the moon, then you call us, you call Sega when you need somebody to design and manufacture your home on mm-hmm. the moon or in orbit. Yeah.
Right. Have you got any calls yet?
It's funny. I have gotten calls, but I've gotten calls for astronaut training habitats mm-hmm. on Earth. So that's what the calls are about right now.
Right.
And I feel like if we are getting calls about that, that means the industry is going the right direction. And it also means that we are kind of becoming the brand name mm-hmm. of space architecture.
There we go. So how do you approach that those tasks of building habitats to train astronauts?
So the first thing you need to understand about space architecture is that space architecture is the most honest, it's the most true and transparent type of architecture. And I think it's because if I design a summer house, which I'm also doing right now, we are trying to make Europe's most sustainable summer house, vacation home. And when we design that, everyone has an opinion, right? The you know, like all the professors at the architecture school, they have an opinion. All the clients have opinions, and the clients' family have opinions, and everyone has opinions about what that type of architecture mm-hmm. should look like. And there's stylistic expectations. Should it be postmodern? Should it be modern? Should it be square? Should it be, you know, there's all these expectations. What's interesting about space architecture is that there's no expectations, or mm-hmm. the expectations might be a little immature. It might be like Star Wars or something like that. But there's no one knows what space architecture should look like. We haven't built, you know, we've been building houses on Earth for thousands of years, yeah. but we haven't been building houses in space, only very little. I think designing for outer space is one of the most rewarding things you can do, because you get to determine almost like accelerated evolution. You get to figure out what should that architecture look like.
Right. Now that makes sense. And so how do you build these things? So what is your opinion on that?
So humans need the same thing if they are on Earth or if they're in orbit or if they're on the moon, on Mars or whatever.
Just more pressurized.
they need some pressure, of course. They need a little bit of gravity. It's good for the bones and the tissue and all of that. But we need the same things. We need to be with other people. We need to have a stimulating environment. We need privacy sometimes. We need social activities other times. We need gravity. That's a tricky one. Mm-hmm. But we need food. We need flavor. We need changing weather, for example. That's one of the mm-hmm. things you don't have in space. One of the biggest problems in space from a psychological point of view is that every day is the same. Mm-hmm. So today is the same day as yesterday, which was the same day as 100 days ago. All the days feel the same. So one of the big challenges that we are trying to solve is bring the natural variation mm-hmm. that we have from, you know, just the weather. You know, earlier today I was in Copenhagen, Denmark. Now we are sitting in Riga. And that change in weather makes me understand time better.
Right.
And we don't have that naturally in space. So those are some of the things that we do. Of course, there's some of the things we need more of. For example, you feel very quickly, you feel very alone, right? Mm-hmm. When you're in space. You might be with 2-3 other people, but you feel very lonely. And so social interaction all of a sudden becomes much more important than it might be on Earth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so before you started getting those calls, how were the astronauts trained normally like?
Quite similar, actually. Mm-hmm. So in the early days of the Apollo program, they actually built training habitats. And, mm-hmm. and it's called analog habitats. And there's a famous one on Hawaii. There's analog habitats in caves. They're all around the world. Mm-hmm. And there's also one underwater. And since the early Apollo days in the 60s in the US, astronauts have trained underwater. Mm-hmm. And the problem with most training habitats is that it's not dangerous. And that sounds...
isn't it a good thing?
That's actually not a good thing. Mm-hmm. Because you want of course, control, a little bit of controlled chaos, but you want to train the astronauts to understand how they behave themselves when they are in these stressful situations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the first time you experience a pressure leak or an air leak is in space while there's everything is happening and adrenaline pumps and everything, that's not the first time you want to try that. You want to test some of those things before that. Also, what does claustrophobia or cabin fever feel like? That's also like you want to know how you react in those type of environments before you go there. And most of these habitats are not dangerous enough. They can call a doctor. They are 15 minutes away in a jeep and all of these things. But there's so what we're trying to do with our habitats is make the most realistic, find the most realistic environments on Earth, be it the North Pole or underwater, which we have done, and then test it there.
And you've been the one testing
quite often. so far, it's I've always been on the missions where we tested our structures. So we design and build these prototype habitats ourselves, and I have been there every time. Yeah.
So how many days did you spend in the Greenland, was it?
Yeah, exactly, in Greenland. So we ended up spending close to 100 days in Greenland by the North Pole, close to the North Pole. And we spent 2 months inside the habitat itself. It took about 30 days to set up everything.
How big was the habitat?
It was smaller than this room that we are sitting in now. So it was 4.5 square meters. That's about 50 square feet if you're American.
And you were two people.
Two people. And, you know, I'm a pretty average-sized human being, but one of my co-founders that I was there with, you know, he's 2 meters and 6 centimeters tall. So it was, you know, we definitely put it to the test. But that's also why I can confidently say now, after spending 2 months, two people completely isolated, 1,000 kilometers north of the Arctic Circle, I can tell you with confidence that you can live comfortably in a very small apartment. So we did 4.5 square meters. Now we are designing some student houses as well. And there, you know, I'm trying to convince the real estate developer, you know, 10 square meters is actually quite big, you know.
you will have to convince the students, I'm afraid, as well.
That's true. But I think if I remember what it's like to be a student, students are actually, they want excitement and they are actually okay with it. As long as the rent is fine.
Yeah. No, that's probably also true. Are there any moments that were the most, that you will remember the most of those 60 to 100 days?
That's a great question. People often ask me, what was it like or what did you feel? And that's such a difficult question to answer because when you're there for so long, you feel everything, right? You have periods of sadness and tiredness and exhaustion and you just want to cry, but there's also excitement, right? But if there's a few moments that stick out, it is when we got visited by a polar bear.
Oh, okay.
that of course stands out. So we were never confronted with it face to face, but I woke up one night and looked out through the small window. It had just been snowing the night before, a few hours before, and I could see big fresh footprints, maybe 20 minutes old, right, in the snow, 2 meters in front of the door. So I go in and I, you know, there's a feeling when you see that and you just know, you know, there's only one animal with paws that big, you know, it's the size of dinner plates, you know, and I had been reading a lot about polar bears and preparing for the mission and, you know, it's the biggest land-based predator. It's 650 to 700 kilos of just predator, right? And it's just, it doesn't care, right? So, and we are sitting in this moon habitat made out of carbon fiber and all of that. And anyway, I go in and I sit and I try to relax. I make a cup of coffee. I lock the door. You know, the door is not locked because you don't expect any visitors. You know? So I lock the door and I take my rifle, right? So we have a rifle. And I sit and I wait for Carl to wake up. And he doesn't wake up. And I sit and I'm trying to read a book. And I just cannot read that book. Because all I'm thinking about is the polar bear. And then I hear something at the door. And I think it's the polar bear. And I wake up Carl. And I throw the his rifle on his bed, and I say, there's a polar bear outside, and he hears it as it's a polar bear inside. So he jumps out of his bed and he thinks there's a polar bear inside, and in his underwear, you know, he's, you know, we are just two scared young guys with rifles. And but then, you know, we figure out that it's gone. But the moment when we open the door and we have to see if the polar bear is still there, that was a moment that I remember, because I, you know, I closed my eyes very briefly, and then I just really wished to God that I was not in Greenland. I just wanted to be home for a second. But, you know, now it's okay.
No, that's definitely a memorable one. But do you think if the polar bear were aggressive, would it be able to?
So, you know, one of our psychologists on the project, he did some research on us. He is ex-Arctic military. Mm-hmm. So he was one of the Danes that actually patrols the area. And he explained that they have some depots for food that they have scattered around Greenland. Mm-hmm. So that the soldiers, when they move around, they have some food and sugar and water and all of that and fuel. And there they have metal doors, and the polar bear, if it's hungry enough, it doesn't care, right? It just strips it right open and goes in. So I think our carbon fiber aluminum structure, it was strong, you know, it was very strong. You know, the winds up in northern Greenland are the strongest winds in the world. And, and there was no problem with that. But I think a hungry polar bear, it could go right through.
Yeah. Wow. So I wanted also to talk about the student house project that you already mentioned. So what's it going to be? So I read in a story there's like a 3D printed concrete building.
Yeah. So since we started the company, you know, we are very fascinated by new ways of building and manufacturing, and I think we are not. You know, I think we understand technology quite well. We are not afraid of it. Mm-hmm. I think many people, especially in the building industry, is a bit afraid. And then, you know, and houses are expensive. So I also understand you need to minimize your risk. So what we try to do is figure out how do we remove the risk, but still move these new technologies forward. And we, for a long time, we wanted to 3D print houses. Again, I think the housing industry, we need a revolution. And I think 3D printed houses will play a big part in that. But no one wanted to 3D print a house. And, you know, every time we had a client, we said, yeah, you can do this and this and this. And the last thing, what about 3D printing it? And then we were like, we'll almost do it for free, you know, as long as we can do this, you know, because we really want to move the technology forward. And no one wanted to 3D print the houses because there was no reference projects. Mm-hmm. There was no, you know, it was difficult to convince the clients. So what we ended up doing was become the developer ourselves. Hmm. And then we started another company 3 years ago called 3DCP Group, where we 3D print houses. Mm-hmm. So Saga, we designed them, and 3DCP Group built it, printed. And we just completed the largest in Central America last year. And then we did the largest in Denmark 2 years ago, and then we just did the largest in Denmark last year, and now we are doing the student houses. We also printed a school in Ukraine, actually.
Okay.
Yeah. I was not involved personally in the project, but the 3DCP group team was there for about a month printing it. And now we are about to 3D print the student houses in Denmark, which is going to be Europe's largest project.
But are we talking about a structure that is temporary by default, or is it going to be is it going to last as long as a normal concrete building would?
It's just as long as a normal concrete building. It is. So one of the issues that we're facing is that we can actually make it. So when you talk about sustainability in housing, and LCA, that's usually the measurement that you use, how much CO2 per square meter per year is the emission of the house and all the materials and end of life and all of that. The problem with that calculation is it only goes to 50 years, and our houses will outlast that. So we are actually stuck there. We have to use this measurement, but we could actually live much longer with the houses that we create, right? So so it will definitely outlast many other building techniques. Yeah.
Right. And how far do you think are we from you being able to actually design like a space habitat?
We could do it today. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no doubt. So we just sent our first small payload to the International Space Station.
Yeah, I was just reading it the other day. Yeah, what did you send? What
yeah, was it? So it was actually, I tried the first prototype on my own body when I was in Greenland. Mm-hmm. You know, we were there during the winter as well, so we had 30 days of complete darkness where the sun doesn't.
That's a great addition to the rest of the stuff you experience.
Yeah, so we were there for 30 days, complete darkness on 4.5 square meters, you know, and there were some days where me and my co-founder didn't talk that much together because, you know, what is there to talk about? during that, we knew that before going into the mission. So we knew we needed to design a solution. And what we came up with was a lighting system that simulates daylight. So we have sunrise, daylight, sunset, twilight, and darkness. And that helps us to understand time, because we don't have to look at the clock. We can actually feel what time of the day it is. But it also helps our sleep. It helps our natural body clock. And that worked so well, it cured my insomnia that I had kind of before. Maybe it was the startup lifestyle that was too hard. I don't know. it cured my insomnia, even though it was stressful and all of that in Greenland. So we got invited by the Danish government to send a payload to the International Space Station. And what we did was we took our prototype of the lighting system and turned it into a space-grade lighting panel that is now on board the International Space Station. And it helps astronauts in their sleeping cabin to wake up with a sunrise, and then daylight and twilight and sunset and all of those things. Yeah.
Great. And so if this is successful, you also expect to do more of that?
Absolutely, yeah. So we actually right now, we are in 2 months, we are launching our Earth panel. So the one we send to space is obviously very expensive. Mm-hmm. Everything is expensive in space. Things are getting cheaper, but everything is expensive. And when we only made 3 of the lamps that went to space, and only one lamp went to space. And then there's one at ESA, and then there's one in our office. And I want that lamp in my own bedroom, but I cannot afford the one that went to space, right? It's too, even though I made it, it's too expensive for me. So we are making an affordable version for Earth that I can have in my bedroom, my girlfriend can have, our small baby can have one, my parents, all our family and friends, all of that. And then we will launch it on Kickstarter here.
And then so, be the same idea, basically, just to...
Exact same technology, just... and half of it is space-grade materials. The other half could be space-grade materials, but it's not certified.
Interesting. Yeah. So when should we expect that?
You should expect that on the 12th of June.
Perfect. That's right before our conference. Yeah. So now you're also busy with the third version of your underwater habitat. The second version you tested yourself, 48 hours underwater, just after we met last time at Tech Barbecue. So how did that test go? And then what are you changing for the third version?
It's amazing we have this interview now, because when I met you 9 months ago, it was, I think it was like 1 or 2 weeks until underwater. Yeah. But so after the Arctic, we knew that the final test for our habitat structures would be underwater. And at the same time, the American underwater habitat for training astronauts got retired. Mm-hmm. So there is currently no operational underwater habitat for astronaut training. So we saw, okay, maybe that is something we can do. So the first step on that roadmap was to design a small, tiny capsule where we could test all the life support systems. Mm-hmm. And then I volunteered to be the guinea pig, right? So I also think it's fun, right? So I like it. So I went down for 48 hours. The entire team was on shore monitoring with the rescue divers and medical divers and all of the stuff that you need, and commercial divers and everything, flight director, technicians. And they were monitoring me every minute of those 48 hours. And that went incredibly well. Okay. The habitat performed better than any of our expectations. And we're publishing a paper on that now, actually. But that was the first step. And then the next step that we are working towards is a full-scale, large underwater habitat that will be ready in 3 years. And for 4 people, around 20 square meters, And hopefully it will be used for astronaut training for the future astronauts going to the moon and Mars.
Mm-hmm. It takes 3 years to build it.
So this summer, we're actually doing an entire mock-up. Mm-hmm. So we are building the entire thing on land that will not be pressurized.
Mm-hmm.
And then we are sending 4 people in that for 20 days.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be finished in September. So that's the next step on the roadmap. And then the final one, yeah, in 3 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Are we going on this one as well?
I think I have to. I think we have a compass streak that I don't want to break. But then maybe after that, I don't know. I keep saying maybe not the next one. But then it's been 9 months since I was underwater. And now I'm kind of feeling the excitement tingling. You know, I need something. Yeah.
Do you know where you want to put it?
We have some interesting locations. I think it will be a collaboration with us and a local nationality. So we're looking at Norway right now. We're looking at Bulgaria. We don't know. But we have some, because the habitat will be used both for astronaut training and marine science, we have some requirements for the site. The habitat is made so it can be moved around. It will not stay in one location forever. But we need to have some biodiversity hotspots or some climate science hotspots where it would be interesting to do some science. And then we need clear water for the astronauts so they can see the habitat and navigate around. And then we also want to test it in some cold water if possible.
Right.
Because I think all the underwater habitats that have existed in the last 50 years have been in Florida, in the nice, comfortable, warm water, and in the Caribbean and stuff like that. And being in the Arctic, you know, I feel like we can do it. Space is cool as well.
And where did you test? You have to?
Sorry?
Where did you test the previous one?
So the previous one we tested in Denmark. So just outside the coast of Denmark. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So also pretty cold water.
Pretty cold water, but it was in the fall, you know, it was not crazy cold.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about it is that the habitats work so that you sink it down on the bottom and then the astronauts swim down after it's down there. So I swim down after without any equipment, just a breathing mask. And then I swam inside the habitat and stayed there. And that was, of course, it's a little bit cold, but it's okay. Yeah.
Wow. And one thing I don't fully understand about the habitats, one thing in the what you get in space is the lack of gravity, right? So is there a way to simulate it in a habitat like this to train astronauts?
Inside the habitat is difficult from an architectural point of view. From you can train it outside the habitat. That's also one of the reasons why the underwater environment is great. You can, in the suit, the astronauts can experience microgravity, what it would exactly would be like, very close to what it would be like.
So it's very close, okay.
Yeah. But from a physiological point of view, you can do some things where you put people in a bed rest study, so they lay down and then you see how does that affect the bones. And of course, it's not a perfect analogy to being in space, but it's close. It's easier to add gravity than to remove gravity.
Yeah.
We have built simulators that actually with the counterweight systems and wires and straps that you actually can put a person in and then they can experience reduced gravity. But the problem with those is the more you want to adjust for the gravity, the more things you have to add to the person. So it's a mechanical device that it works and it's good for training, but it will never be the exact same feeling.
Yeah. So have you raised any money so far, like for the company itself, or are you just like doing projects?
So it's actually quite amazing. So we've been approached a couple of times, but we have said no, and we said keep out. Maybe we will do it in the future, but we have been doing all of this organically. So we can fund a lot of the development ourselves. We are very lucky that we get a lot of partners that provide materials and things for us to test. And then we give them a good marketing case.
Right.
So for example, we had a lot of partners in Greenland. I tested, you know, Bosch professional power drills. We did a lot of stuff. So the tools were sponsored by Bosch and all these things to bring the costs down. And then the profits from a lot of our other projects can kind of feed the R&D. I have to say we are probably one of the architects and engineering companies that I know that spend the most of our revenue back into R&D. I think I don't know the exact percentage, but it's most of our revenue we actually spend on R&D.
Great. Perfect. Now, Sebastian, thank you very much. Thanks a lot for answering all the questions. Good luck with everything that you're doing at Saiga, and I will be following your adventures.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Once again, big thanks to Sebastian for finding the time to come on the show. For us, this is all we have time for in this episode of the TNW podcast. Thank you so much for listening. If you like our show, please help us spread the word. Tell a friend or colleague about the show and follow our updates on social media. Just search for The Next Web and you will find us pretty much everywhere. Our music and sound engineering is done by SoundPulse. Please feel free to email us with any questions, suggestions, and opinions at podcast@thenextweb.com. Once again, our hearts go out for Linnea, who didn't manage to join us this time. We really hope that you're feeling much better. So, I'm Andrei Degelor.
I'm Ioana Licardopoulou.
Have a great week, and we're going to talk to you next Wednesday. Bye-bye.